The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article by Mary Novaria is titled, What an 80-something Couple at the Grocery Store Taught My Husband and Me About Aging. There's nothing especially unusual or remarkable about the older couple I wheel past at the cheese case in the grocery store. She's sporting a faded lavender tracksuit circa the 1970s that's seen better days. Her husband's khakis are baggy, and he's wearing a long-sleeved shirt despite the 90-something degree weather. The duo is huddled together, each steadying themselves with one bony hand on the cart, as they squint at a wedge of sharp cheddar, or maybe Gouda. The cheese is aged, and so have they. Aging is considered desirable in cheese and wine, but for people, not so much. Especially not in L.A., where there are billboards for Botox, plastic surgeons, and vein clinics on seemingly every block. The man and woman both have gray, curly hair in need of a trim. Their skin is thin and pale with age spots, and their hands are lined with blue veins. I guesstimate their age around 80 plus. Normally, as I would be in a rush to get through the grocery store aisles, I might find them annoying. But on this day, I instead find myself smiling at the sweetness of them not only shopping together, but also growing old together. I wonder, would one be able to survive without the other? Or will they be like those elderly couples we read about who die within days of one another? And then, will that be my husband and me 20 years from now? It wasn't the first time I pondered the likelihood of whether John and I will grow old as one. We married right out of college when you just assume you'll always be together. We've done a lot of maturing since. Our marriage has not been perfect, but it has survived raising teenagers, career triumphs and setbacks, and now living, thriving really, in an empty nest. There were moments we didn't like each other very much, but we always found our way back to till death do us part. And the thing is, I do believe we could survive without one another. We just don't want to. We want what our parents didn't have. John's father died 37 years before his mother, while my mother spent the last 14 years of her life without my dad. Our grandmothers also far outlived their husbands, so we don't have familial role models for living together through what my grandmother called the golden years. When she was 77, we moved my mother into her own apartment in a retirement community. I think it was the first time in her life she'd moved into a place on her own. She had what the doctors called mild cognitive impairment. We took away her keys and sold her Mazda, the ultimate loss for a woman who lived in a Midwest suburb where a car is a necessity. Where she lived, she wasn't able to hop on a bus or subway or stroll a block or two to the corner bakery. The loss of the Mazda was the cherry atop a pile of other losses: husband, career, independence, dignity. My mom had a bum shoulder from a fall on her front steps the summer before. After that tumble, she recuperated in our home many times over the next few years, following myriad surgeries and procedures. I saw firsthand how fast things can slide downhill. Hearing, memory, zest for life. At the time of the fall, my mother was still working part-time as a priest in the Episcopal Church. A few months later, she was relieved of her ministry, which I think was at least as hard on her as my father's death. She no longer had a sense of purpose. Despite the fact that my mother's arm was never quite right again, and she was very depressed about losing her job, it was the increasing dementia that was the most troubling. It had been easy for me to write off occasional lapses at first, but after months of denial, her uncharacteristic behavior began to add up. Getting lost on the way to the dentist, buying an expensive vacuum cleaner from a very nice door-to-door salesman, showing up on Christmas Eve with her snow boots on the wrong feet. I began to suspect the church leadership may have noticed her mental decline before the rest of us. Now, months after encountering that octogenarian couple in the grocery store, I sometimes found myself thinking, Is one half of that pair now the designated driver? And if so, which one? Does he still open the door for her, regardless of whether she's the passenger or the driver? Are they still sharp enough to do the crossword? I hope they're still able to cook and clean and haven't become hoarders with too many cats or a den filled with newspapers and National Geographics going back to the 1960s. If they have children, do the kids look in on them? If not, who does check on them? And then there is the big one. Can they remember to take their medications? I had to make a cheat sheet for my mother to make it easier for her to manage her umpteen remedies. Pills for cholesterol, osteoporosis and reflux, more for memory and mood, 3 blood pressure medicines. Does my grocery store couple have a son or daughter who makes them cheat sheets? Maybe they didn't need one. I hope John and I won't need one. Not for pills or for anything else. I'd make a couple of other diagrams for my mom, one for the TV remote and another for her cell phone. Despite that, she still always tried to turn on the television using her phone. She often thought she needed a new mobile, but usually it was just because she'd forgotten how to turn it on. That's when she'd call me from the office in the retirement community, and my heart would skip a beat when I saw the caller ID, fearing another fall or worse. Technology was never her strong suit. For all I know, the grocery store man in the 2 big khaki pants and his lavender-clad sweetheart were computer whizzes or pharmacists or one of each, and they've got their pills and remotes and iPhones down pat. Maybe they're not as feeble as I imagine them to be and have no need for grab bars and raised toilet seats and disposable underwear. 3 years after my mother's death, I think about these strangers hours after I'm home from the store on a Saturday afternoon. I still consider what their evening will be like, what they'll have for dinner, and if they'll watch a movie on TV, or if they'll sit in comfy his and hers chairs reading books while listening to big band music. Maybe tomorrow they'll go to church together and hold hands in the same pew they've been sitting in for the last 50 or 60 years. Afterward, they'll go to their favorite diner for breakfast, and the waitress will know their names, even though I do not. Maybe someone, a friend or neighbor or family member, will visit in the afternoon and stay for an early supper that includes a homemade pie, and they'll shake their heads in dismay while discussing current events. Later, they'll kiss each other goodnight and murmur in the dark about something they forgot at the grocery store, and then they'll sleep until the birds begin chirping at daybreak. We never know what the following day will bring, let alone what the next decades have in store. Honestly, I don't spend excessive time thinking about the future, except for my fantasy of having my writing published to wide acclaim. I'm 59. Retirement still feels far off, though I do picture John and me in a beautiful spot with water or mountains or both, a place that's near our 2 kids and their spouses and possibly some future grandkids. There will likely be a dog. Funny, the paradox of wanting to defy age while at the same time wishing for it. I can't picture a life in which either John or I grow old without each other. Of course, pragmatism insists we plan for such things, but I remain generally in denial about the possibility, pushing away vague fears that I could develop dementia and hearing loss like my mom, or heart disease, arthritis, and cancer like my dad, as if wrinkles, muscle stiffness, and stubborn belly fat aren't reminders enough that I'm pushing 60. But even if I could know the future, I don't want to, ignorance being bliss and all. I'd rather be surprised, delighted, and hopeful. So if John and I are together deciding between the Harlsberg and the Havarti 25 years from now, I pray I'll know how fortunate we are, because I have a feeling aging gracefully just might be tied to gratitude. And maybe one day in the future, there'll be some 50-something woman looking at a 2044 version of John and me, one who notices our veiny hands and silver hair. I pray we'll be aware enough to keep our card out of her way, both in the cheese aisle and over by the Chardonnay. And I hope she'll smile at us as she realizes that she wants the same till death do we part, in sickness and in health, fruitfully aging partnership for herself. Our next article by Alexis Jones is titled, How True is the Act? The Hulu series backstory is chilling. Mother-daughter relationships are undeniably complicated, but few compare to the one depicted in the Hulu series, The Act. Starring Joey King and Patricia Arquette, The act follows the toxic and ultimately fatal relationship between Gypsy Rose Blanchard and her mom Dee Dee Blanchard. In the trailer, Dee Dee is portrayed as a mentally ill, overprotective parent who raises her daughter Gypsy Rose to believe she's terminally ill. Gypsy Rose's list of supposed illnesses and disabilities range from leukemia to paraplegia, epilepsy, heart murmurs, and more. But as Gypsy Rose grows older, she starts to uncover the truth and soon learns that everything from her illnesses down to her age has been a lie perpetuated by her mother. The only way out of her trapped and tortured life, as Gypsy Rose sees it, is to kill her mother. And with the help of her internet boyfriend, that's exactly what she does. It's a horrifying story to say the least, but even more awful is the fact that the entire series is based on a real-life story. The story of Gypsy Rose has previously been told in an HBO documentary and a Lifetime movie, after initially being brought to life by a BuzzFeed long read. But here's the haunting truth about the Blanchards. Dee Dee Blanchard began diagnosing Gypsy Rose as early as 3 months old. Gypsy Rose Blanchard was born in Golden Meadow, Louisiana on July 27, 1991. According to the 2016 BuzzFeed article, Gypsy Rose's father, Rod, recalls her being born a healthy baby. But when she was just 3 months old, Dee Dee became concerned that her newborn had sleep apnea. She began taking her to the hospital and, according to Rod, put Gypsy Rose through 3 rounds of tests and a sleep monitor. But the doctor still didn't find anything wrong with her. Nevertheless, Dee Dee insisted that her daughter actually had a chromosomal defect and was too ill to hold. And as Gypsy Rose grew older, Dee Dee's diagnoses became more and more serious. Eventually, Gypsy Rose was told she had cancer, epilepsy, and muscular dystrophy, and was placed on anti-seizure medication and began eating through a feeding tube. A 2018 ABC News article reported a closet full of medications that Dee Dee convinced doctors to prescribe to Gypsy, none of which she actually needed. "The only thing I had wrong with me is I have a little bit of a lazy eye. Not all the time, but I have better vision in my left eye than I do in my right eye," Gypsy Rose said in an interview with 2020. "That's it." It's thought that Dee Dee Blanchard had Munchausen syndrome by proxy. According to the Cleveland Clinic, Munchausen syndrome by proxy is a mental illness also known as fictitious disorder imposed on another, or FDIA, which induces a person to act as if they are caring for someone with a physical or mental illness, or in Dee Dee Blanchard's case, both. As BuzzFeed noted, with Dee Dee dead, there's no way to actually confirm she had the disorder. But all signs, from the false diagnoses and nonsensical list of drugs to the manipulative behavior, point to FDIA. ABC reviewed Gypsy Rose's medical records and concluded that she was treated by at least 150 different doctors, but every appointment had one thing in common. Gypsy Rose never spoke. Dee Dee did all the talking, giving the doctors a detailed account of her daughter's symptoms, aches, and previous illnesses. Gypsy Rose became a local celebrity. According to ABC News, in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina in 2005, Gypsy Rose and her mother were housed in a local shelter in Covington, Louisiana. After their story spread, they were moved from Louisiana to Springfield, Missouri. Dee Dee had already convinced doctors that Gypsy Rose's medical records were lost in the hurricane, along with many of their belongings. Soon, the story of the displaced single mother slash caretaker and her disabled daughter caught media attention. Gypsy Rose and Dee Dee were moved into a house built by Habitat for Humanity and were flown across the country for celebrity meet and greets, concerts, speeches, trips to Disney World, and more. Gypsy Rose's medical bills were covered by Medicaid, though her mother convinced her that they were surviving solely on donations, food stamps, and Social Security. Later on, Gypsy Rose discovered that her father had been paying child support her whole life, despite her mother portraying him as an alcoholic drug addict in order to maintain the public's sympathy and charitable donations. Dee Dee refused to tell Gypsy Rose her real age. According to BuzzFeed, Rod Blanchard said that Dee Dee lied to Gypsy about more than just her illnesses. She refused to even tell Gypsy Rose her real age. Rod remembers calling to wish his daughter a happy 18th birthday, but before he could speak to Gypsy Rose, Dee Dee intercepted the call, cautioning Rod not to mention her age. She thinks she's 14, Dee Dee said. She told Rod that revealing Gypsy Rose's real age would only upset her. According to an ABC News article, Dee Dee forged Gypsy Rose's birth certificate on at least one occasion, changing her birth year from 1991 to 1995. Gypsy reportedly asked her mother several times how old she was, but each time Dee Dee would become more and more upset. It was about a good span of time between, I want to say, 2001 to 2015, that I really wasn't sure of my age, Gypsy Rose told 2020. Gypsy Rose managed to develop a secret online love affair. According to a Washington Post article, in 2012, Gypsy met her first boyfriend and future murder accomplice, Nicholas Godejean. Based on Gypsy's actual birth certificate, she would have been around 21 years old. The two met online on a website known as Christian Dating for Free, as reported by the Springfield News Leader. The internet was a way for both of them to connect socially when the real world was isolating. Gypsy was controlled by her mother's strict rules and watchful eye, and Godejean was an autistic man, whose job included holding a sign outside a local pizza place, according to the Washington Post. Gypsy Rose Blanchard is currently serving a 10-year prison sentence for her mother's murder. The fake diagnoses, tests, and abusive behavior went on for as long as Gypsy Rose could take it. And then one day, she'd had enough. In June 2015, Gypsy, then 24 years old, posted to her Facebook account, "That bitch is dead." The next post described, with detail and profanity, how her mother Dee Dee had been killed and how Gypsy Rose herself had been raped. After a 911 call from a concerned neighbor, the police obtained a search warrant and found Dee Dee stabbed to death in the bedroom. According to BuzzFeed's reporting, she'd been dead for several days. Gypsy Rose was gone, though she was later apprehended. She has since opened up about the murder, which she called Plan B. In a 2017 interview with Dr. Phil, Gypsy Rose explained that she and then-boyfriend Nicholas Godejean, referred to as Plan B, their plot to kill Dee Dee Blanchard. She went into detail about sneaking out to see a movie with Godejean, where afterwards she asked him to kill her mother. She said that she had been desperate and saw murder as her only way out. Still, in the years since the death of her mother, she's expressed remorse. Gypsy Rose, now 28 years old, serves a 10-year sentence at the Missouri Chillicothe Correctional Center. She was convicted of second-degree murder, while Godejean serves life for the first-degree murder of Dee Dee Blanchard. Throughout the 21 years Gypsy Rose lived with Dee Dee, she endured countless forms of abuse, mental, physical, and emotional. Her story is a sad and unfortunate one, but one whose resurgence will likely continue the much-needed conversation around mental illness and the healthcare system that failed a little girl. You can watch Gypsy Rose's story portrayed in the Hulu series, The Act. Our next article by Mackenzie Jean Philippe is titled "The True Story of Hollywood's Hattie McDaniel, the First Black Oscar Winner." Thanks to Ryan Murphy's Hollywood, we now know a little bit more about the riveting true stories of a handful of Hollywood legends. There's Rock Hudson, Anna Mae Wong, and one Hattie McDaniel. Portrayed by Queen Latifah, McDaniel was famous for being the first African-American to ever win an Oscar for her role in 1939's Gone with the Wind. She left an undeniable legacy in the industry. In Hollywood, her story gets a bit of Murphy's revisionist treatment by being welcomed to the historical ceremony that she was actually shut out of in 1940. It was very emotional to have these people get justice and to be seen and to have acceptance, which everybody should have and want, Murphy told The Hollywood Reporter. It was an emotional thing to give them the happy ending that they had been denied. Below, we detail McDaniel's extraordinary story and all the triumphs and struggles of her career. Hattie McDaniel knew she wanted to be an actress at 6 years old. The 13th child of two former slaves, McDaniel was born in Wichita, Kansas in 1895, but raised in Denver, where she discovered her love of the stage and decided she wanted to be an actress at age 6. According to the Colorado Virtual Library, she said, "I knew that I could sing and dance. My mother would give me a nickel sometimes to stop." She dropped out of high school at age 15 to pursue her career, touring small towns in the U.S. with her brother's carnival company, and eventually created a women's minstrel show with her sister called the McDaniel Sisters Company. The Colorado Virtual Library reports that it was during this minstrel show that McDaniel developed her comedic Mammy character, who defied and critiqued racial and gender stereotypes of the era. The actress also dabbled in radio, but it was her job as the lead singer in George Morrison's Melody Hounds, a touring jazz orchestra, that spurred her popularity, leading her to Hollywood in 1931 and her first film role in 1932. She was the first Black actor to win an Oscar. McDaniel's first studio contract was for Judge Priest in 1934, in which she sang a duet with vaudeville actor Will Rogers. A year later, she shared the screen with beloved child star Shirley Temple in The Little Colonel, and according to The Hollywood Reporter, she formed a close relationship with Clark Gable while filming China Seas in 1935. In each of these films, she played a maid, contributing to a total of 74 servant roles throughout her career. But as we know, her most famous of all was that of Scarlett O'Hara's head servant Mammy in the 1939 epic Gone with the Wind. The Hollywood Reporter reports that Bing Crosby, a friend of McDaniel's brother, who was also an actor, suggested her for the role that would win her an Oscar for Best Supporting Actress. The show took place at Coconut Grove Nightclub in the Ambassador Hotel, which didn't allow Black patrons at the time. Gone with the Wind producer David O. Selznick put in a special request to allow McDaniel in the building, but she had to sit at a far table against the wall separate from her co-stars Gable, Lee, and Olivia de Havilland. "My own people were especially happy," she said of earning the award. "They felt that in honoring me, Hollywood had honored the entire race. That was the way I wanted it. This was too big a moment for my personal backslapping. I wanted this occasion to prove an inspiration to Negro youth for many years to come." McDaniel faced criticism from fellow African Americans. But despite her place in history, McDaniel was rejected by the NAACP because they felt her film roles perpetuated racist stereotypes of Black people, particularly after her participation in Gone with the Wind, as they opposed the novel's use of the N-word, though McDaniel refused to say it in the movie. Smithsonian Magazine reports that in a 1947 Hollywood Reporter article, she defended herself, writing, "I have never apologized for the roles I play. Several times I have persuaded the directors to omit dialect from modern pictures. They readily agreed to the suggestion. I have been told that I have kept alive the stereotype of the Negro servant in the minds of theatergoers. I believe my critics think the public more naive than it actually is." The star would go on to appear in over 300 films, according to the Colorado Virtual Library, but her career prospects weakened following her Oscar win due to Black activist groups like the NAACP advocating for the end of the typecast role she dominated. McDaniel's most notable part in the latter years of her career was in Walt Disney's controversial Song of the South in 1946. However, a year later, she did become the first Black woman to star in their own radio show for the successful comedy series Beulah. She supported those in her community. The actress did her best to use her success to uplift peers in her community. McDaniel's biographer Jill Watts told NPR in 2005 that she had an open-door policy with fellow African-American creatives at her L.A. home on South Harvard Street. "Within the walls of her home, they're able to perform the way they want to perform," Watts said. "This is post-Academy Award for the first few years. I think she was quite hopeful, and she wanted to share that success with others. She supported family and friends. People talk about how people would just come to her and she'd give out the money she had, so she's quite generous in that way. She also put together entertainment for Black World War II troops, donated to the NAACP despite their disavowalment, and was chairman of the Negro Division of the Hollywood Victory Committee from 1941 to 1945, according to the Colorado Virtual Library. So, did she have a relationship with Tallulah Bankhead? Hollywood heavily hints at the fact that the two were an item, but there are only decades-long rumors to support this storyline, as a relationship between the two was never confirmed. However, McDaniel herself was married four times, losing her first husband to pneumonia, with the other three marriages ending in divorce. She never had children. Before she died, McDaniel left distinct instructions for her funeral. McDaniel died at the age of 57 in 1952 of breast cancer, but not before throwing a deathbed party that was said to have people milling around drinking and laughing, according to the Hollywood Reporter. She even left precise instructions for her funeral. "I desire a white casket and a white shroud, white gardenias in my hair and in my hands, together with a white gardenia blanket and a pillow of red roses," she wrote. Another wish was that she be buried at the Hollywood Forever Cemetery, but at the time it was for whites only. She was laid to rest at the Angelus Rosedale Cemetery instead, but a marble memorial was later built for her at her original choice of resting place in 1999. Our next article by William Harvey is told to Eleni N. Gage, is titled, "I Survived the Holocaust and Went On to Thrive in Hollywood." I was married for 42 beautiful years, and I almost missed meeting my wife because I was tired and didn't want to shave. It was 1953, and my friend Arthur had insisted I drive him to a dance at the University Synagogue in Los Angeles. When we got there, I told him, "I'm going to nap in the car. You go in." Soon he came back with two girls and said, "They want to meet the Continental." That was the title of a late-night TV show where the host had a European accent like mine, and the name of the salon I just opened, the Continental House of Beauty. One of the girls, June, looked like Jennifer Jones from that picture, Love is a Many Splendored Thing. She was so intelligent, her friends called her the Walking Encyclopedia. Later, when we were married, we would go to parties at my clients' homes with big movie stars, and afterward, June would say, "Bill, I looked around the room. Nobody was better than you." That's how she felt. I started washing and ironing my own clothes back in Czechoslovakia at age 7 because my mother had to work. She supported 6 kids as a highly skilled dressmaker. After World War I, my father was in and out of veterans' hospitals. When the Germans took over our city in 1944, they noticed him walking with a cane, very frail, and beat him so badly. He died soon after. 3 weeks later, they established a ghetto in an old brick factory and took us all into it. My mother and my two sisters, who still lived at home, my aunt and my cousins. After 6 weeks, they piled us into a cattle car headed to Auschwitz. As soon as we got there, they herded the men into one storage facility and the women into another. Those structures had no walls, just roofs, and all of us were naked. I tried to keep track of my mother and my aunt, but, oh, it was terrible to see their humiliation. Then they separated those who would go to the gas chamber from those of us who were young and healthy enough to work. That's when I lost sight of everyone. They marched us past the gas chamber to the barracks. I was in a trance. It was impossible to understand what I was seeing. What I remember most are the people who were already in the barracks, their swollen faces and eyes. They didn't look like human beings, just skeletons with skin. Once a day, they gave us a bowl of soup that 5 or 6 of us had to share, passing it mouth to mouth. I couldn't bring myself to eat it. The people from my city who were there told me, "Vilmos, if you don't eat, you're going to die. You never get used to it, being stripped of every inch of human dignity, but I wanted to survive." Eventually, I drank from the bowl. Auschwitz was a hell place. I stepped outside the barracks at 4 a.m. for roll call and saw dead people piled on one another like garbage, so high that I had to look up to see the sky. But I was lucky. I was only in Auschwitz for about 12 days before I got picked for a work detail in the Bavarian mountains. I worked there for almost a year, rebuilding a gas refinery every day after the Allies bombed it at night, digging tunnels through the mountains for train tracks. When the SS realized they were losing the war, they took us to Buchenwald, then ran to save their own lives. I was frozen stiff. Thinking I was dead, they threw me in with the bodies being carried to the crematorium. One of the prisoners who worked there noticed I was alive and brought me to the infirmary. I woke up 5 days later to learn we had been liberated. I heard the Americans are here, but I was too weak and numb to feel any real joy. Soon after, I learned that my mother, my aunt, my cousin, and her children were gassed immediately after we arrived at Auschwitz. I cried for 3 months in a displaced persons camp in Germany. Then I realized that with all my crying, my mother was still not coming back. I decided if you feel sorry for yourself, you won't have a life. You have to choose. So I immigrated to the U.S. I never talked about my experiences during the Holocaust with my wife. She was born in America, and I felt that it is very difficult for people who don't come from this background to understand. The only reason I was able to make a life for myself is that I blocked out some of what happened. I don't even remember the name of the person who slept next to me in the barracks. Such a nice young man, we were so close in such horrible conditions. I forgot his name on purpose, otherwise I might remember everything. 3 days after I arrived in New York, the boat I was on docked the 31st of August 1946. I got a job as an errand boy in an international beauty shop where the staff spoke some of the same 5 languages I did. That way I was able to learn English and make a living. By the end of that year, I was styling hair for the stars of Radio City Music Hall, Broadway, the Metropolitan Opera. These beautiful ladies showered me with tips, and after 3.5 years, I saved enough to move to Los Angeles, where I had an uncle I'd never met. I went to night school, earned my U.S. high school diploma and California cosmetology license in 6 months, and eventually opened 2 beauty shops, where I worked with Judy Garland and other big stars. For years, I saw my mother in my dreams. My only regret is that I couldn't save her or make the end of her life comfortable. But I was able to help my sisters and their families emigrate to the U.S., educate my nephew and my daughters, and care for my wife when she was sick with cancer. I still live in the same Los Angeles neighborhood we moved into 65 years ago. Everybody knocks on my door. My grandsons call me for advice almost every day. For me, what's remarkable is how a human being can recuperate from a corpse to a human again. When the war ended, I was 21 years old, 72 pounds. I couldn't even stand. Now I'm 96, and here I am. Our next article by Imani Bashir is titled, Blake Bolden is the first black woman to play professional ice hockey. It's 4:30 in the morning. Before most of the world has even thought of hitting their alarm twice, Blake Bolden is already headed to her early morning workout. Such is the life of a professional hockey player and a full-time trailblazer. At the age of 25, Bolden became the first black woman to play professional ice hockey, with her debut in the National Women's Hockey League, or NWHL. Since then, Bolden has become a 3-time NWHL All-Star and 2019's NWHL Defensive Player of the Year. She also holds the honor of having the fastest slap shot in the game, a move in which a player strikes the puck in a sharp, sweeping motion. After playing for the Boston Pride, the Buffalo Buttes, and Switzerland's HC Lugano, the 29-year-old now applies her acumen as a full-time hockey scout for the Los Angeles Kings. Bolden's path to athletic stardom was unusual, especially compared to her teammates' trajectories. People who start playing ice hockey usually come from families of fanatics and are learning to skate almost before they can walk, Bolden tells OprahMag.com. Instead, the Cleveland-born athlete came to the ice at the age of 7, nearly by chance. At the time, Bolden explains, her single mother was balancing motherhood and working 3 jobs. Then she met her boyfriend, the man whom Bolden considers her father, and everything changed for the family. He swooped us up and introduced us into his life and his environment. He worked part-time for the International Hockey League. Since he had a media pass, I just followed him everywhere around the rink, which gave me a front row seat into the game and made me say, "I want to try it," Bolden said. It took Bolden 3 years to get on par with other skaters, who began as wobbling two-year-olds. After playing track and field, karate, and gymnastics, Bolden found she had a natural affinity for the sport. But hockey posed challenges that were not technical. Back then, Bolden competed on exclusively male-only teams. Each match, she was the exception on the ice, the only black kid, and the only girl. Bolden found she needed to develop another skill, one that would serve her throughout her career, fortitude. For me, I was always focused on the fact that I was the only girl on the team, in the league, and the only black person overall, so I had to push through, Bolden says. She was 12 when she joined her first all-girls league, the Ohio Flames. Through these experiences, Bolden realized she didn't just want to be great at hockey. She wanted to be the face for young black girls who needed visible representation, that they could take up space in an alternative avenue, whatever their choice may be. Bolden's love for the game has transcended some of the hardest challenges an athlete can face, many of them outside the rink. In an interview with OprahMag.com, Bolden opens up about being overlooked by brands and sponsors, snubbed by the Olympic national team, and judged by people in the stands. What keeps Blake going is her passion for the sport and creating an avenue for other black athletes to follow in her path. "I want to be a staple in the sport so that others will say, 'I did this because of Blake Bolden,'" she says. Oprah Mag's interview begins with the question, "Ice hockey is a pretty hard-hitting sport. How are you able to navigate that space and not get extremely hurt?" "You just have to learn to hit and protect yourself the right way. I've gotten my bell rung a few times just from people finding out I was a girl. But hockey is a game where nothing can stop you. You literally have to get up, dust yourself off, and keep it moving. Plus, being the only girl on a boys' team didn't grant any moments of pity. For me, I was always focused on the fact that I was the only girl on the team in the league and the only black person overall, so I had to push through." Youth sports can be taken extremely seriously by parents. What was playing hockey like growing up? How did they treat you? The parents were probably worse than the kids, honestly. The things that my mom would hear in the stands about me were absolutely rude and disrespectful. It was always a combination of racism and sexism. Obviously, children mimic the energy of their parents, so I would bear the brunt of some kids' learned ignorance. It didn't bother me because I felt protected by my team. I felt my team had my back and would get people together, but it wasn't fair for my mom, who was supporting her child just like other parents, to be subjected to such nastiness. I still believe it was much harder for her hearing grown people say these types of things about a child, her child. Did you and your mother have the conversation about your race and gender and how it might impact the game? There wasn't much she really had to say, although we would have the talk. It was more of how she handled everything, the way she lived her life, and the way she led by example that let me know I could do anything I wanted and excel at it. Based on her work ethic and everything I saw in her as a black woman, it made me want to push even harder. One of the main issues women of color in professional sports face is getting opportunities for brand deals and sponsorships. Has that been consistent with you? Let's begin with the fact that I'm not on the National Olympics team, and everyone seems to have some reason as to why. None of those reasons add up to the talent I gave and what I represent in the sport. I have won world championships with Team USA. I won Defensive Player of the Year. I've been in All-Star games. I think it's ridiculous. I feel like this stuff tends to be more personal rather than my skill not being up to par. Now I'm playing just simply to be that diversity for the sport, no matter what deals come my way. It's unfortunate. This could have been something groundbreaking for the sport, not as a handout, but really showing off that I do have the skill to compete on this level and supported by brands who believe in diversity. I can only amplify my voice to a certain extent, so partnerships, sponsorships, and other opportunities are what takes it the rest of the way to market this sport and introduce new audiences to it. But I have the fastest and hardest slap shot in professional women's ice hockey at 87 miles per hour, yet I have never been approached by any hockey stick companies for an endorsement. With all the obstacles and triumphs you've had in your ice hockey career, what is your ultimate goal? As I talk more about who I am and what I bring to the sport, awesome things have been happening for me. I know that there is value to what I have to offer and know that I am marketable. I want to be the best motivator for making hockey cool and inclusive. I want to be a staple in this sport so that others will say, I did this because of Blake Bolden. I want to move into front office roles where I can have a greater impact on decision making on behalf of women and women of color in this sport. Maybe I'll own my own team one day, but I think telling my story is helping to establish important conversations that'll positively impact the next generations. Our next article by Amy Macklin and Molly Sims is titled, How to Be a Better Friend in the Digital Age. Though so many of us are suckers for romance, friendships may be the true love stories, the bonds that really complete us. A friend knows our secret aspirations, petty aggravations, every daily triumph and despair. She's our memory bank, moral compass, and reassurance that we aren't the only person on earth who's equally passionate about season one of Outlander, putting more women in Congress, and Hot Pockets. A good friend exerts a gravitational force in our lives. Even, or especially, in moments when everything threatens to fly apart, she pulls us back to ourselves. We see our friends and our friends see us with a clarity that other people don't, not even our romantic partners, says Lauren Meschling, whose novel How Could She explores the complexities of female friendship. To be known that way is incredibly important. Friendship helps us define who we are. But these days, it's getting harder for us to define what friendship itself is. Social media has turned friend into a verb, not just a thing that we are, but a thing that we do, or undo, as in the Orwellian-sounding unfriend. On Instagram, we connect with strangers who invite us to join them where we used to hang with our nearest and dearest, in the dressing room at Target, on the couch at wine o'clock. Meanwhile, our actual friends sometimes look like strangers, flatteringly filtered, perpetually hashtag blessed, and often having too much fun with the other filtered hashtag blessed people who don't happen to be us. In this universe of insta intimacy, it's good to remember that friendship is still a matter of the heart, not heart emojis, and as such must be handled with care. That's the spirit in which we crafted our guide to being a better friend in the digital age. Because in the vast reaches of cyberspace, the network that matters most is yours. Use the tech. So much has been written about how technology is weakening the delicate fabric of human relationships. Heads buried in screens, conversations replaced by keyboards. But the truth is, it can do wonders to knit us closer together. Remember the girlhood dream of staying friends forever? Our apps and devices can make that dream come true, offering a connection to people you thought were lost to the sands of time. Your bestie from third grade, who was always sticking up for the kids who got bullied? She's now a public defender with four rescue cats and a lively social media life, and she'd be thrilled for you to get in touch. Today we could take our friends with us everywhere, virtually. One FaceTimes you from London, walking you through the Tate Modern. Others group text while watching Big Little Lies together, sharing reactions in real time. We can stream and snap our way into each other's lives with next to no effort. But don't overlook the power of a phone call. Of course, the existence of all of this bridge-building tech doesn't mean you can skip out on spending time with your dearest pals in real life. The offline touch is especially vital when they're in need. Khalil Gibran called friendship a sweet responsibility, which nails both its benefits and its obligations. If your friend is dealing with something big, divorce, a death, a troubled child, a career shift, your job is to be with her in person or at least call. Yes, even if you're crazy busy or hate the phone, your voice on the other end of the line is more powerful than any text. FYI, psychology professor Albert Mehrabian found that 38% of communication about feelings occurs through vocal tone. Texts, emails, and DMs are like emotional cliff notes. They give an outline of the story, not the full sentiment behind it. In person or on the phone, you can hear your friend's unguarded thoughts, pauses, sighs. Research has found that it could take over 200 hours together in person before someone becomes a close friend. And that's not an investment you want to squander. Just as you wouldn't conduct a romantic relationship virtually, you can't sustain a friendship that way. Connect over the silly things. Tiny moments add up. Have a minor revelation. I just realized I've been mixing up Jeff Daniels and Jeff Bridges for the last decade. Blips of contact are the dabs of emotional glue that keep your connection solid. In my closest friendships, we can obsess over anything for any amount of time, says Kathy Guswhite, Kathy cartoonist and author of 50 Things That Aren't My Fault, a collection of candid essays on womanhood. When my niece graduated from high school, my sister planned her party down to the tiniest detail. She texted me photos of napkins as she walked through Party City. That's exactly the kind of thing we bond over. Remember, the person on the screen is not your friend. Yes, the woman in those Instagram posts looks like your buddy Kim. Same mole near her left eye, same habit of snorting when she laughs. But she's not actually Kim. She's a meticulously crafted avatar, a presentation of the woman Kim wishes she were, or the woman she was in late 2004, or the woman she feels pressure to seem to be. In the social media era, many of us feel compelled to offer up our most charming, carefree, Ashtanga-practicing selves to the world. That presentation can be at odds with the way our real-life friends know us, sometimes creating a jarring dissonance. It can be disorienting, for instance, to watch a friend perform marital bliss on social media when she spends half your conversations fretting about her jerk of a husband. But before you judge her for being a phony, think of the pressure she must be feeling to keep up appearances. Real Kim may need your forbearance for screen Kim's behavior. Social media just isn't the setting for the kind of authenticity and vulnerability that's the bedrock of true friendship. That knowledge will help when screen Kim fails to provide online evidence of your friendship. Author Lauren Meschling vacationed with a close friend's family in Italy a year ago. After returning home, Meschling plastered her Facebook page with pictures. Her friend did not. "I was shocked and hurt," says Meschling. "Why didn't she want to brag about our cool vacation and the fact that we grilled fish together and listened to Sicilian accordion players? It bothered me so much that I finally brought it up, and she explained that her father didn't like how he looked in the photos. She was trying to protect his feelings." One last thing about real Kim, it's not fair to make her take a back seat to your on-screen persona. As we mine our daily lives for content and imagine how it'll play out on an internet stage, we sometimes fail to be fully present in what's happening around us. She's confessing to troubles with her boss, and you're mentally concocting an Instagram post about your super fun hashtag ladies night, hashtag yum, hashtag love my friends. But the phantom eyeballs of your online followers aren't nearly as important as the ones you're looking into across the table. So let your paella go unphotographed occasionally. The likes you'll garner aren't worth the distance you might create between you and the people you truly hold dear. Just say no to FOMO. You know how horrible it felt when Tina Capicolo didn't invite you to her Sweet 16 and you had to hear about it at school later while gritting your teeth hard enough to create a diamond? Well, thanks to social media, you can now regularly experience that emotion as an adult. We have immediate front row seats at beach getaways we weren't asked to attend, and the pang of exclusion stings just as badly now as it did back when you used Jean Nate. Do yourself a favor and try a little perspective. Pre-internet, this kind of thing happened all the time. You were just blissfully unaware. Speaking of awareness, this is a good time for a self-audit. There could be a simple reason you weren't invited. Maybe the group assembled to obsess over a novel you haven't read, but it could also be more personal and complex. Is there a lingering grudge you and your friend haven't addressed? Maybe you've been distant lately and she thought you were pulling away. Have you been spilling her secrets? Dominating chats with 20-minute diatribes about how maybe it's finally time for you to get Botox? Keep in mind, too, that you've probably caused FOMO yourself with no negative intentions. Give your friend the same patch you'd want to receive. If you really can't stop licking your wounds, it's fair to bring up your agitation nicely with those who left you out. One night several years ago, my Instagram blew up with photos from everyone I knew at a friend's party, and I hadn't been invited, says the actor Busy Phillips, who has 1.8 million Instagram followers and considerably fewer close friends. My feelings were really hurt, so a couple of days later I called the person and said, I need to talk to you, because it feels like this was a thing. It turned out that it was, and we got to the bottom of it, and we got through it. Kill your friends with kindness. Social anthropologists Laura Aramian and sociologist Peter Mallory have studied the reasons friendships fail and found three recurring issues that can cause a downward spiral. An imbalance in effort or affection. One always reaches out to schedule lunches, the other can't be bothered. Differing expectations. Michelle doesn't think twice about calling Liz every day to complain about relationship drama. Liz sees that as a ludicrous burden. And problems with overlap. Resentments about deadlines or workloads making things awkward between coworker pals. Inspired by Marie Kondo, people are doing the painful emotional work of parting with things that no longer mean what they once did. But those things can't take it personally when they're heaped into a hefty bag. The process of breaking up with a friend, on the other hand, is a psychological minefield that can cause long-lasting injury. One reason is simply that we know our friends so well. Research has shown that we're better at describing our friends' creative skills and intelligence levels than they are themselves. If you have to fire an employee or break things off with a romantic partner, they could tell themselves it's for subjective, superficial, or nonsensical reasons, says Lauren Meschling. But you and your friends know each other so deeply that if one rejects you, it's hard not to feel that she's seeing something in you that she doesn't like, something you might not even have found within yourself. If you're the one doing the rejecting, you owe it to your friend to proceed with extreme benevolence and care. Before you decide to part, ask yourself if you can let your grievances go, if being spared your pal's critiques of your outfits is worth losing her impeccable sense of humor. I pick my battles, says Busy Phillips. You can't call people out for every single thing, like posting too many selfies. Sometimes you have to be like, okay, she needs some kind of validation that I can't give her right now, so I'm just going to sit back and let this pass. I've gone through phases where I'm sure I'm not that cool to be around either. You can lie low, dialing back the frequency of your calls and emails in the hopes of conveying how close or distant you'd like to be without having to get explicit. Whatever grievances you can't let go of, don't hash them out on screen. Since online conversations lack the nuance that face-to-face or phone conversations offer, minor email or text misunderstandings could turn into full-fledged warfare. Psychologists also warn of online disinhibition, the tendency to be bolder and more open, and sometimes more aggressive, when you can't see someone's face or hear their voice. In other words, the email you'd write to a friend you're peeved at will likely be much more barbed than what you'd say if you were telling her off in person. No matter the disagreement, it won't be solved by broadcasting your annoyance to your 236 Facebook friends. And if you eventually make amends, that public record of your clash will remain like a gruesome scar. But if the friendship is run aground and you're ultimately unwilling or unable to bring it back to sea, if things become endlessly contentious or painful, it's probably time to call it quits. It should go without saying that this is not a text message situation. What situation it is depends on numerous factors: your emotional closeness, the problem at hand, the personalities of the key players. Each friendship breakup is as unique as a thumbprint and as complicated as a trigonometry equation. Consider whether this is a time to be direct in person, send a judicious email, or quietly slip away. Your friend is likely to scrutinize whatever you do or say as intensely as if it were the Zapruder film, so be respectful and merciful. Some breakups are just the natural order of things. I had a friend in high school who was brilliant and very bossy, says Rose Chast, illustrator of Why Don't You Write My Eulogy Now So I Can Correct It, a collaboration with longtime friend and writer Patty Marks. We had some fights over the years, and after a particularly bad one, without any explanation, we just stopped talking. Sometimes a friendship, especially if it's very complicated, doesn't end all wrapped up in a nice, neat package with a bow on it. And if you're on the receiving end of a breakup, take comfort in the fact that friendship can work in mysterious ways. Once a close friend didn't talk to me for about a year and never explained why, says Marks. I didn't ask because I thought, it's not going to be a good reason. It's not, I love you so much that I can't bring myself to talk to you. And eventually she started talking to me again. We'll end this week with a message from Oprah. This week I would like to dive into something that you've probably heard me talk about before if you've ever read Oprah Magazine or watched The Oprah Show. And what I'm talking about is listening to the whispers. Now you see your life whispers to you all the time if you're paying attention, from the moment you open your eyes in the morning until the moment you go to bed at night. It's just speaking to you. And really, hearing those whispers is one of the most integral pieces of the puzzle, I believe, that's needed to put together the bigger picture of your best life. Now, there might be a message sent or meant for you that first comes in a whisper that to you sounds like, that's strange, or, that seems odd, I didn't leave that door open. But then if that whisper isn't addressed, the whisper will become amplified, getting louder and louder until it suddenly becomes what I call a big thump on your head. And if you're still not paying attention, that little nudge transforms into a brick of a problem. And then eventually all of those ignored bricks that make up the structure and stability of your life come crashing down. So know this for sure, life is whispering to you all the time. It then turns into a brick of a problem. I've learned over the years to kind of pay attention and heed what's whispering before it has to knock me upside the head. So many things in life are out of our control, but I do know that many things are in our control unless you choose to sleepwalk your way through it. So I ask you, what is whispering to you right now? I encourage you to take the time to observe and listen, become aware, and learn to discern what your head is saying versus what your heart is saying. And sometimes you may follow a voice in your head that's not your true calling, and that's okay too, because you get as much from the losses as you do from the wins. So I say just keep listening, being aware of what is whispering to you now, and have a beautiful week ahead. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.